This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. Today, we'll start our show with Sue Skaliski. She's the Program Coordinator for Humanities North Dakota, and we're going to talk about the Game Changer Ideas Festival, which gets underway tomorrow, Sue.
Yeah, hello. Thank you for having me on the show.
Let's talk about the idea of a Game Changer Ideas Festival. What is it? How does it work?
All right. Well, we have this big flagship event once a year, and normally it's in person until this year. We're virtual this year, but basically it's a gathering of lifelong learners where curiosity and discussion take the center stage. So we gather up the most respected and informed thinkers in our country to come share their knowledge and their experience with certain topics. And this year we are virtual. Our kickoff event is tomorrow. We have six events over the next 3 months, and they all revolve around the question of what issues are facing our democracy right now.
Well, some pretty stern ones, actually. This is quite topical. So how will you kick it off tomorrow?
Tomorrow is very timely. And when we booked this event months ago, we had no idea where our country would be. But tomorrow we're hosting Yael Eisenstadt. She's a former CIA officer, a former diplomat. She served as a special advisor in the White House, even worked at Google for a short period of time until she resigned when she saw what was going on there. And she is going to come on and share her solutions and answers to the question, is social media destroying our democracy?
Well, we've got a little sample of Yael Eisenstadt, so let's listen to her make the argument.
Around 5 years ago, it struck me that I was losing the ability to engage with people who aren't like-minded. The idea of discussing hot-button issues with my fellow Americans was starting to give me more heartburn than the times that I engaged with suspected extremists overseas. It was starting to leave me feeling more embittered and frustrated. And so just like that, I shifted my entire focus from global national security threats to trying to understand what was causing this push towards extreme polarization at home. As a former CIA officer and diplomat who spent years working on counter-extremism issues, I started to fear that this was becoming a far greater threat to our democracy than any foreign adversary. And so I started digging in, and I started speaking out, which eventually led me to being hired at Facebook and ultimately brought me here today to continue warning you about how these platforms are manipulating and radicalizing so many of us, and to talk about how to reclaim our public square. I was a foreign service officer in Kenya just a few years after the September 11th attacks, and I led what some call hearts and minds campaigns along the Somalia border. A big part of my job was to build trust with communities deemed the most susceptible to extremist messaging. I spent hours drinking tea with outspoken anti-Western clerics and even dialogued with some suspected terrorists. And while many of these engagements began with mutual suspicion, I don't recall any of them resulting in shouting or insults. And in some cases, we even worked together on areas of mutual interest. The most powerful tools we had were to simply listen, learn, and build empathy. This is the essence of hearts and minds work. Because what I found again and again is that what most people wanted was to feel heard, validated, and respected. And I believe that's what most of us want. So what I see happening online today is especially heartbreaking and a much harder problem to tackle. We're being manipulated by the current information ecosystem, entrenching so many of us so far into absolutism that compromise has become a dirty word.
So Skaliski is the coordinator for Humanities North Dakota's virtual Game Changer Ideas Festival, which starts Thursday with that person you just heard, Yael Eisenstadt. Sue, how did you come up with the topic? You mentioned that it was sort of prescient given what has happened, but the planning started long before this, didn't it?
Yeah, you know, the planning started in the spring when we knew we had to cancel our in-person Game Changers. So we're like, what can we do virtually? And we started planning. We thought, you know, being an election year, we looked at, you know, we really need to look at our democracy and what that means. And, you know, when you look at the events leading up to and following the 2020 election, it became very clear, like we had a hint of it, but it became very clear that our American democracy is very fragile. And even more than that is we believe it is dependent on a thoughtful and informed citizenry. And so that's what we do. We don't create and curate events to come up with consensus. We want to provide opportunities for people to come listen and debate in good faith these issues that are foundational to our country. And I would say, in addition to the Game Changer Festival, I want to not forget that to mention that we are also offering free adult civic education classes. And the first one will begin February 24th. It's for 6 weeks. And I don't know about you, but in light of everything, I've been asking myself, do I really fully understand the Constitution? Do I fully understand the Bill of Rights? And this is a fun class taught by a constitutional scholar, absolutely free.
I remember in seventh grade, we had a course called civics, and we had to learn how a bill becomes a law and all of that kind of stuff. And maybe it's time to revisit that kind of curriculum.
Absolutely.
The Game Changer Ideas Festival is virtual, as you mentioned. It's available at humanitiesnd.org. It's easy to find it on your website, and you can register there. There's no cost, but so you do want to keep track of people, though, I take.
Yeah, you know, we really want to keep people informed of the programs that we continue to create so that, you know, we deem ourselves a gym for your mind, you know, especially being January. It's easy to find a gym to keep your body healthy. But what do we do about our brain? And so we're that gym. And if you register for our event and get that link, we can keep you informed.
Well, what is your role as coordinator? Are you the person who's in charge of this whole thing?
We have four staff members. I have the best job of the four. Sorry to my colleagues. I get to spend all the money. I get to find all the speakers. I get to create the events. And I'm constantly sending out surveys after events to see what the people of North Dakota want to discuss, what they feel is important. And so if you're listening right now, please reach out. Just get on our website and reach out to us about what it is that we should be discussing.
As you mentioned, on Thursday, that is tomorrow, Yael Eisenstadt will speak about his social media destroying our democracy. In another week, on Thursday, January 21st, can political innovation break partisan gridlock and save our democracy? And, you know, again, this is like ripped from the headlines, isn't it?
It really is. You know, she co-authored a book with Michael Porter, The Politics Industry, and we're just seeing it play out right in front of us.
And this is Catherine M. Gale, the founder of the Institute for Political Innovation.
Yep. And Dave Ailes, CEO and president at American Bank Center, will be serving as moderator that day.
Now, how do you respect and validate people, given the very intense political environment we're in, where the partisan divide has probably never been deeper, and on one side of the argument is literally and often disinformation? How do you have a meaningful discussion with somebody who comes at you with facts that aren't facts?
You know, that's a really good point. And what we're learning by what we're doing and what we offer is we create spaces for people to come have that discussion that emphasize looking at one another's humanity and what we have in common. And the more, you know, we're in a difficult situation with the pandemic, where normally we believe wholeheartedly in face-to-face conversations, because it's kind of hard if you sit face-to-face talking with someone that you can't find some connection. We usually do, especially in North Dakota. Someone knows someone who grew up near where they grew up. And so it's that humanity, and there are commonalities. The other thing is, and I heard this from a marriage counselor, is what he noticed with people who were just irate at each other was that they were normal differences but they were magnified by hurt. And so if we can, in good faith, come together and just honestly say, I'll listen. I can't guarantee you I will agree with everything that's presented. But the thing about our programs, too, is we're not TEDx. We don't just have speakers speak. We always provide a time for discussion, for Q&A, for everyone's voice to be heard, and for answers and different ideas to be a part of the mix. So it's difficult, but it's definitely doable. We're all human.
Well, Yael Eisenstadt talking about social media. It's on social media where we see the kind of coarse public discourse that makes people angry, where insults are just thrown back and forth as opposed to meaningful and respectful disagreements. Part of this is part of the process has to be just accepting what are the agreed upon facts around which we'll have the discussion.
Absolutely. And, you know, Yael, in talking with her and booking her for this event, you know, she used to sit as a CIA officer, sit with terrorists, very dangerous terrorists. She's had tea with them. And she said they always found some commonality. She was always treated well. They were always able to have a discussion, even though they couldn't agree. And so that's what we're aiming for.
A couple of weeks after next Thursday, January 21st, February 4th, the topic is, what is the future of the Republican Party and conservative movement? And that is a conversation that's nationwide right now.
Oh, man. You know, I think the two are very, very different these days. And the gentleman we're having come speak about that is Peter Wehner, and he is at the Public Policy Center, Ethics and Policy Center. But he was the very first Republican prior to Trump being elected in 2016 that spoke and wrote about publicly that, this isn't the Republican platform. And so he's gone on, remained a just steadfast Republican, but is speaking about where are we now? Let's go back. The platform is good, but where are we now? And that's going to be an incredible conversation.
One of the things that's out there that I think we have to deal with is that some people conflate the humanities, and for that matter, sometimes the arts, with liberal ideology. How do you confront that notion?
Right. That's, again, it's all about the conversation. And it's all about bringing, who do you bring to the table to have those conversations? You can't stack it with those that you agree with. And so there's an element of courage in bringing people to the table, which is what we want to do. No matter what North Dakota citizens believe, where they're at, come to the table and listen, and let's talk about it. For that event with Pete Wehner about the future of the Republican Party, State Senator Nicole Pullman will be serving as moderator. And so that'll be an interesting conversation between the two of them.
2 weeks after that, February 18th, again a Thursday, America came together a century ago. Can we do it again? Reminding us again of we're in this historic moment in our political life in this country.
Yeah, and to not give up hope. I mean, we've been here before. And so she's great, a delightful person to talk to. I don't know if you know, but she's Mitt Romney's daughter. But she co-wrote the book, The Upswing, with Robert Putnam. Great book, very insightful, very hopeful, very positive look at where we are at today.
Well, as the daughter of Mitt Romney, I would suspect she'd be sort of a middle of the road, if you will, Republican,
yeah.
Sort of the rock-ribbed Republican I remember as a kid, the Rockefeller Republican.
Yes.
But that's part of the issue that you're going to be dealing with the week before. That is the
Absolutely.
Republican and conservative movement issue. Are
right.
they the same, or are they going to be two different things at some point? You mentioned the importance of diversity in both the presentation and the people who participate. How do you avoid singing to the choir?
Oh, wow. I didn't realize you'd have such tough questions for me. Unfortunately, the choir always shows up. And by the choir, I mean those who are dedicated to lifelong learning. It doesn't matter where you're at, again, what you believe, but are you dedicated to learning on a day-to-day basis, every day of your life, and not letting your paradigms be cemented where they've always been, but to have an open mind, have an open heart, and again, look at the humanity around you and what we do have in common. So the people who do come to our events, are those lifelong learners. We are North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community. But in this past year of being virtual, our membership is growing by leaps and bounds. People are finding a need to come together and figure out what is this, all of it, and how do we get through it.
Sue Skaliski is the coordinator for the Virtual Game Changer Ideas Festival, which is put on by the North Dakota Humanities. And you can find out all about it at humanitiesnd.org and that and other enterprises of the humanities organization. Sue, you mentioned the importance of diverse messaging and the better outcome if you've got a diverse audience to get in conversation about this. How do people interact with each other during the festival?
You know, the festival is a webinar, a Zoom webinar. So the only way to ask questions and communicate would be through the chat feature and the Q&A feature. So, it's fun to sit and watch it unfold because there is that back channel of conversation. So in the chat, people are able to bounce ideas off, ask questions that the moderator will bring up to the speaker, or other people who are attending will share their input on a question that is brought up. And so although people's faces aren't on the screen, it is very interactive.
On March 4th, that's again a Thursday, does social unrest help or hurt our democracy? We've had some exercises of social unrest, and one could argue that it certainly pointed some sharp fingers at other people, but has it helped or hurt our democracy? That's a great question.
Yeah, and entitling this talk, at first we're like, well, let's talk about protests and politics. And I contacted Diva R. Woodley, and man, she's just passionate about looking at the power behind social movements. And we've seen so many play out this year. And it's really what's each individual person choosing to look at in the social unrest? Is it hurtful or is it actually helping? Do things change until things get bad, or can they change without things getting bad or public? I think that's the big thing. Cancel culture is a big part of that social unrest. So we thought this isn't just about protest. This is about social unrest when society is publicly, loudly uncomfortable.
Sue Skaliski is coordinator for the Virtual Game Changer Ideas Festival. It's Thursday, starting tomorrow through March 25th, when the last element of the discussion is, what does the Declaration of Independence mean today?
Oh, yeah. Right? Again, we're giddy about how all these are so timely. If you're listening, please share this. Please share all these great conversations coming up. They're absolutely free. And that last one with Danielle Ellen, we really need to look at the meaning for today. And historically, all documents, when were they written? What was the meaning there? And that's why we have amendments. And so she's going to really go through what that looks like today.
These are webinars that take place at specific times and on specific dates. But after they have been conducted, will people be able to access the festival and see recordings of these presentations?
Yep, absolutely. So during the webinar, they will also be streamed on Facebook Live on our Humanities North Dakota Facebook. And then they will be left up on our website, the recordings, through the duration of the festival, which will end on March 25th. And then after that, those recordings will be placed in our vault. And our vault is a members-only area on our website, and they will always be there. So not only will the Game Changer recordings be there, but our One Book, One North Dakota, our Brave Conversations, any of the recordings of events and programs that we've had in the past will be in that vault. And if I can mention, becoming a member at Humanities North Dakota is not hard to do. It's simply a minimum of $50 donation a year. And all the events and classes, actually, all the classes are free. Normally, we charge for Game Changer, but this year, we just had to offer this information for free to the people.
So if you're a member of Humanities North Dakota, you get into the vault.
Absolutely. And there's a lot in the vault. You want to be in the vault.
Is the Game Changer Ideas Festival thing done elsewhere?
You know, many different places offer a festival. Aspen Ideas Festival, Chicago puts on a huge festival. And so we've kind of, you know, we are constantly looking at how to do things better and a higher quality. For example, our last in-person Game Changer was down at the Belmehus. And this coming year, October 7th, we're going to have it at the Bismarck Event Center. So we're going from sitting as an audience to sitting at tables, again, because we wholeheartedly believe in the face-to-face connection, that human connection, the ability to listen and also to be heard.
It reminds me of the Chautauqua, which is a very old version of, you know, having people presented with ideas and maybe even engage in discussion.
Absolutely. And it's interesting you say that because we have a Chautauqua and chat program as well. And we've offered a few of those online. So if you're a member in the vault, you can see those recordings as well.
Well, a very long time ago, back in the late 70s, I was actually a member of the Chautauqua group that toured the state of North Dakota for the Humanities North Dakota organization. Long time ago. Now, are you planning for next year?
Yeah, we have Game Changer this coming October 7th in Bismarck is well underway. Everything's set, but 2022, we're going to be hosting that Game Changer in Fargo.
And do we know what it's going to be about yet, or is that?
Not yet, but boy, we have some great ideas.
In the meantime, you've had to cope with a pandemic and have had to reinvent the Game Changer Ideas Festival to a virtual one. There are some advantages to online delivery in that people don't have to physically come someplace.
Oh, absolutely. And we've heard over and over from literally hundreds of people in rural North Dakota begging us to please not stop the virtual programming because they have finally been able to attend our program. So we, going forward, we're definitely going to be hybrid.
Sue Skaliski is program coordinator for Humanities North Dakota. It gets underway Thursday, January 14th. Find out more information at humanitiesnd.org. Sue, thanks for spending time with us.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Coming up on Main Street, a commentary by Mark Trahant and a conversation with U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz is calling on the Minnesota National Guard to provide security during demonstrations in the lead-up to the presidential inauguration. Walz says he has been briefed on known threats to the state capitol in St. Paul. He says the officers will not stop the exercise of free speech, but will ensure a safe environment.
You can probably anticipate you will see a presence of folks protecting folks' First Amendment rights to peacefully assemble and protest. I would make the case that you got a pretty weak argument if you need to bring a gun to do it.
Many states are stepping up security after last week's events at the U.S. Capitol. A West Fargo lawmaker believes some parts, at least, of the two interstate highways serving North Dakota should have an 80-mile-an-hour speed limit. Republican Representative Ben Koppelman says in other states with an 80-mile-an-hour limit, their number of fatalities have actually dropped at a higher rate than North Dakota's.
So I believe what we can take away from this is cars are becoming safer. I think the highways are probably patrolled better, and ultimately people are driving safer. And thus, that allows us to go up with the speed limit.
But Koppelman says his bill takes into account road design. He says there would be some money in the bill for added barricades between lanes and a redesign of some of the curves and inclines. Koppelman says he's been working with Transportation Director Bill Panis.
In his research, it appears like Interstate 29 could, a large chunk of it could be 80 miles an hour almost right away. And in Interstate 94, I believe it's somewhere in that 20-25% is kind of in the green right now. And I think some of the additional, if we can say yellow or the kind of a slight risk level can be improved with guardrails, and maybe that can get in the green. So I hope to have at least half of Interstate 94 to be 80 miles an hour, you know, this biennium.
Koppelman says his bill does not address other four-lane highways such as US 2 or US 83. And a project is in the works to use ethane to generate electricity. Bakken Midstream Natural Gas has announced a large-scale baseload power plant to be built near Williston. It will be called the Williston Basin Energy Center. Bakken Midstream CEO Mike Hopkins says ethane has a high heat content and there isn't much demand for it in North Dakota.
You have all this natural gas that comes with your oil. You've got to keep the gas moving or you won't be producing your oil. And the ethane, because it's high heat content, and you have a lot of it, relatively speaking, compared to other states that produce oil and gas, you've got this, I'll call it a developing problem.
Hopkins says ethane is best used close to the supply, and he says that's what will happen in this project. He says now plans will be drafted to get the ethane to the plant. He called it a value-added project for North Dakota's oil and gas industry. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Mark Trahant's commentaries offer a native perspective on issues and events. Mark is the editor of Indian Country Today. His commentary today looks at the impact of the pandemic on his online news service and the people he reports about.
Indian Country Today was in an expansion mode. We hired new reporters. We had the prospect of our first managing editor. We were building a business team, and we prepared for a national weekly television broadcast. The atmosphere in any newsroom is exciting. Television monitors keeping track of events in real time, reporters on the phone talking to sources, ideas being batted around, pure energy. Then Dalton Walker attended an investigative reporters and editors training session in New Orleans. 2 days after he returned back to the newsroom, one of the participants tested positive for COVID-19. A couple of weeks later, our newsroom was empty. I've been back a lot lately, and the quietness is unsettling. Desks are empty, the phones are quiet, even the television monitors are turned off. But the thing is, we found a new way to work. The news did not stop, nor did our reporters, our editors, and our broadcasters. To put this into perspective, 2 years ago, Team ICT was at 3 people. We ended 2019 with 9 people. This year we begin with more than 20. It's funny, as fast as we have grown, nearly every day we feel like we need more people. Our ambitions always exceed our resources. How do we best report on all of the important news in the Indigenous world? Indian Country Today's readership is an amazing story. We reached 5.9 million people this past year, nearly 8 million page views. The demographics have remained remarkably consistent. More women than men at 56-40%, and we continue to be stronger with young readers, 21%, our ages 25-34. The geography of our readership pretty much spreads across Indian Country, including urban areas, and just 7% of our readers come from Canada. Over the year, just less than half of our readers find us through social media, mostly Facebook. About 650,000 people come to ICT directly. This is our version of subscribers, even though we're free. Regular readers who check in daily, and sometimes several times a day. Our broadcasting team continues to grow as well. Our plan and our budget was to produce a weekly news show for PBS stations in the fall of 2020. But when the pandemic hit, our daily Zoom calls quickly morphed into a daily newscast. Now we produce that show Monday through Friday. This week, that broadcast will evolve, with one of our shows becoming a regular weekend offering for PBS stations. This is how we change the story about the Indigenous world, by reporting on everyday events armed with the tools of journalism. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Mark Trahant and Native Issues at IndianCountryToday.com. Next on Main Street, U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo.
Support for this program is provided by the Moore Family Dakota Paper Component Fund of the FM Area Foundation, a family and business serving the region's communities for over 100 years.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo has been appointed for a third term, making her only the second laureate to receive such an extension since the position was established in 1943. She's also a musician and playwright and a member of the Muskogee Nation. Today we share an encore interview with Harjo from a year ago when she spoke with Lori Walsh, host of In the Moment for South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Joy Harjo, welcome. Thank you for making time for us today.
Yeah, it's good to be talking to you.
You write in Crazy Brave about that time in the 70s where there was really this indigenous artistic renaissance and your connections with so many other artists. Did that period continue? Do you see that is still happening today, sort of that artistic output and celebration of the arts and activism?
I think it's, you know, certainly being at IA and being part of that or watching it happen or being inside it while it was happening, you know, caused a major shift. And I think it's probably connected to all of them and maybe activism. To be a Native, just to be a Native person is an event of activism, mm-hmm. just our presence here, here in this country.
Tell me, your childhood is spent, you live in this sort, you inhabit this really poetic place, and you tell stories about, you know, playing with bees, for example, and not getting stung. There's many examples of how you're in this space that some people wouldn't recognize. How do you look now as an adult back at your childhood and connect that with poetry?
I think as children, well, for one, we're closer to that door of emergence where we came from, and we haven't. We're still connected to we realize that we're creative souls, even without, you know, we don't need anyone to tell us. Children are just naturally open and creative, and a lot of times our educational system, you know, we start to shut down. You know, we start to shut down with challenges. You know, if that part of ourselves, if our spirits aren't fed, you know, that kind of creativity can be shut down, especially in a society that doesn't value what it means to be a, you know, creative person, an artist.
Yeah. How has that shown up in your life? People not valuing you as an artist, you as a poet, you as a musician. What does that look like? What does that look like in your life?
I'd rather look at people who were wonderful and helped out. And sometimes it's even just the small things. I was an art student at the University of New Mexico, and I would go into this art supply store. And I remember going in and seeing Pablito Velarde, who was an amazing Pueblo painter, and she looked over at me and gave me a big smile, and it was a welcome, like, yes, you know, we're Native women, you know, and she was, you know, Native women making art, and it was just like my grandmother and my aunt, who I was so close to, and, you know, small things like that matter. And then I've had some incredible teachers through my life, and I would prefer to think of them and how that, you know, I got help, you know, we all need, it's there. And it's often in those small moments of saying, you know, affirming someone's existence or their gift, whether they're a child or, you know, someone older.
And you're that person who does that for so many others now, especially in this new platform as a U.S. Poet Laureate. Are you recognizing those people that, you know, you can tell when you meet them just by the looks on their face that that you are opening that door for them, that you are affirming for them their own poetry, their own value, their own expression?
Well, that's the gift of this position, because, you know, positions also, it's an honor, and there's a lot of responsibility, but the gift of it is that just coming in at this time, you know, as a Native woman, as a poet, in a time like this where there's a lot of, you know, the country is split and, you know, it's a broken heart, essentially, that stepping into the position at this time, you know, it's a doorway. And in that doorway, there's not going to be any fixing of that broken heart until all the stories, you know, of the people of this country are acknowledged. And, you know, and poetry can do that. Poetry is a way to speak beyond words. And so I think of all the Native poets, a lot of people will say they've even never even known there was a Native poet. And what this position says is, yes, there are Native, you know, there are Native poets. Yes, we're human beings. It really does come down to that level. And yes, we write poems. And it's not just me. We have hundreds of Native poets, very young and older than me.
And it says something, you know, people have commented on what it says at this particular day and age in American history that they chose you, that they chose a Native American poet, that at a time when there is brokenheartedness, that they said, this is who we need right now, this voice. Turn your ears in this direction, please. What do you sort of see your role as during your tenure? You know, what do you have in mind?
Well, I'm a poetry ambassador for everyone, or for the poetry, for the art of poetry.
Yeah.
But what's important is that the country see how we're connected, Native poets, that there are it's important that they know that we're all still here. There's over 500-something federally recognized tribal nations, and that there are many poets. There are many who practice this art, who listen. Poetry is an art that we all need it. We can all use it. So at the next fall, I have I've helped edit, along with many, many of our best Native poets, an anthology, a Norton anthology of poetry, of Native poetry. It's historic, you know, from the oldest poems we could find, mostly in English, some in our native languages, to the most recent, youngest poets. And so that's, you know, that's going to be part of it, you know, to show that, you know, we all, you know, we're also part of this whole story, this story of poetry, the American story of poetry, just like we're essential to the American story, you know, of history, of what this country is.
What are some of the early representations of poetry? Are they all tied to music and song and prayer? What are you finding some of those early representations are?
Well, the earliest one we have is from the Kumulipo, which is a Hawaiian, I think it's like the Hawaiian creation story, some beautiful poetry from that. And most, I think it's not just indigenous poetry, but I think most poetry of the world is not written down.
Right.
When I went to look for poetry after I'd studied poetry and read, you know, read poetry in books mainly, is that most of our poetry is, you know, we sing it and we speak it. There's some incredible, very Muscogee-type speech-making that goes on in the circle that is sheer poetry, and it's a whole different art. It's an art form. And so we have examples of some of those earliest poems, and then the earliest poem in English we have is by a young Native man who passed really young. His name was Eliezer, and we don't know his tribal affiliation. And he was published by Cotton Mather, of all people. And I think the youngest poet is a young Diné or Navajo poet, Jake Skeets, who has a new book out, just out.
Right. Fascinating. You mentioned music, and music is such a part of your life. Will you tell us a little bit about, as a child, finding music for the first time? Because it's such a, it's such an important formative story that I think a lot of people who follow your work know. But people who maybe don't know you, what's one of your earliest memories of experiencing and discovering jazz and music?
Yes, that moment. Yeah, it was back when there were, this will tell how old I am, when there were no seatbelts.
Right.
So my favorite place in the car, my dad always had a really nice car. He used his Indian oil royalty money to upgrade his cars. So I think it was a black Cadillac. And I remember standing behind him and smelling Old Spice. And I love the radio. And I was probably, I would guess I was about 3 years old, maybe three, four years old. And the radio was on, and I heard this sound. I realized it was Miles Davis' trumpet. Hmm. And I went into this space. You could call it an intuitive kind of space. But I went into this space where I experienced everything in that moment. It's like where I kind of walked through time, and I could see my parents from a distance as if I were much older. And it was just a moment of having compassion for that moment, and hearing in my ears opening, or being opened by the sound of that Miles's horn.
And you write about this sort of this bending of time, and this the way time is folded, also in American Sunrise and some of the poetry there. You know, riding in your car on the road to Atlanta, now you're an adult, you're driving, and you have this other sort of time-bending moment where things that happened in the past are happening right now. Do you think poetry keeps you connected to those kinds of experiences?
I think so, because to become an artist, you know, anyone who's practicing their art, you go into that, you're quiet. What happens in the quiet? Well, you're no longer, just hearing the sound of your voice yammering, but the quiet opens many, many doors into imagination, into the ancestral zone, into the place where the plant, you can hear the plants and the stones. And, you know, that's, artists create out of that kind of space. We all need it. And it's less and less these days when everyone is, has constant access to, 24 access to, anything you can find on the internet. Mm. It's cut out a lot of that creative, that listening time, so that we learn not to listen, not just to each other, but not even to ourselves.
Is everyone in that sense a poet, or is there room for people who don't see them? How do you sort of, the age-old question of, can anyone write poetry? Can anyone connect with poetry? Who's poetry for? How do you sort of view, that kind of big picture question about poetry?
You don't have to be a poet to write poetry. It's a useful tool. It's a useful tool for getting to know, what's going on, how it is moving, there's something very satisfying to be able to either move your body to music, or move your mind, or move your words to a kind of word music, or to an image, paint something with images with a poem, or move towards a kind of knowing that wasn't there when you started writing with your pen or pencil or on the computer. And, we go to poetry, we come to poetry for understanding, for point, places of transformation, like birth, death, falling in love. There's more songs devoted to that, or falling out of love, I think, than any other kind of poetry, any other kind of poem, marriage. Any of those points where we witness something that terrifies us or gives us awe, great awe, or even small momentarily awe, it's a useful and incredible tool.
Mm. An American Sunrise is described sometimes partially as a dialogue with history, as you revisit some of these places where people were forced to leave everything behind, and yet you also evoke a strong sense of present, of being, people who are currently being forced to leave a place they love behind. How do you see that connection? Talk a little bit about that, if you will. you know, the Trail of Tears and the current, you know, migration and challenges people are facing today?
Yeah, I start the book with a quote by one of the survivors of the Trail of Tears who says, when we basically, you know, when we made it to India Territory, or what's now Oklahoma, they killed all of our babies. And that it's a terrifying thought to lose all of our children for anyone. And I think about the border. I think about how a lot of what's going on politically in this country was the same thing going on during the time of Andrew Jackson. Mm-hmm. And it's a very similar kind of time, you know, and Andrew Jackson illegally forced our removal of many, many tribal groups in the Southeast and around the country, too, not just in the Southeast, out of their homelands. And it's similar. There's a similar thing going on at the border because, for the most part, those are indigenous peoples. And there are old migration routes, but, you know, universal law, you know, states, and it's built into every cell of our hearts, is that you do not bring harm. You do not harm children. You do not bring intentional harm to children and families. And that's what's being done in our name here in this country. And that's what was done in the name of the country, you know, during removal, where our children were either, you know, killed on the Trail of Tears or taken away to be raised without their families, without their languages, without their home, without, you know, to break the heart, to break up a people.
As part of that
story of people.
As part of that conversation, do you feel sometimes poetry is the best way to address that, part of a larger tapestry, inadequate to address something? Like, what do you have a sense of how poetry intersects with meaning during such challenging historical times?
There's many ways. Not one art or not one form cannot address everything. We need, all the different arts, all the different ways of expressing ourselves, you know, towards a compassionate world. And poetry is part of that. Poetry is one of the tools. There are many tools.
You mentioned one of the things that really struck me about Crazy Brave, the memoir, was this, what you call the knowing that has served you throughout your life. I guess I would have called it intuition if I was talking about myself. But you have this sort of deeper sense of the knowing and sort of being in tune. To tell us a little bit about what you mean when you say that, and how you can tap into that knowing to help find direction in your own life.
Yeah, I tried to find a way to talk about that in Crazy Brave, because it's something that is inborn with everyone.
Yeah.
And it's that, you know, we're living in a, you look around in the space, there's what's in the, it's like there's all kinds of space, there's all kinds of frequencies. And I guess for me, the knowing, it came, you know, at a very young age. I was always, I often, even as a little child, I liked the company in that kind of space. I liked being in that kind of space. And I liked a lot of time, I still do, I like a lot of time alone. To be in that. And I think every human being needs, you know, that ultimately it's about knowing yourself, which is about, you know, knowing the world. Hmm. If you don't understand yourself, you're not going to be able to connect to anyone else either.
U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo in a conversation with South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Laurie Walsh. Dakota Date Book is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 13th. William Geimer was born in Jamestown, North Dakota, in 1925. After graduating from Jamestown High School, Bill entered the U.S. Navy in March of 1943 during World War II. After basic training, Geimer became a gunnery mate and was assigned to the USS Mazama. The Mazama was a large Navy ammunition ship that served in the Pacific. Navy ammunition ships were named after volcanoes, mountains that could explode. Ammunition ships could do the same. The Mazama was named after Mount Mazama, a collapsed volcano in the Cascade Range in Oregon. Duty on ammunition ships was not very desirable. Because of the ordnance they carried, they were known for spectacular explosions that would also wipe out anything in the vicinity. As a result, unless they were loading munitions on other ships, they often anchored off by themselves. The Mazama participated in the Battle of the Philippines and Leyte Gulf. While anchored at Ulithi Atoll, Geimer witnessed the first successful attack of a Kiton, a Japanese manned suicide torpedo which sank a fleet oiler on November 20, 1944. By December 1st, the Mazama headed to Espirito Santo to replenish her munition stores. Fully loaded, she returned to Ulithi on January 5, 1945. While at anchor on January 12th, another Kiton got by the submarine nets and was sighted off the Mazama's starboard quarter. Minutes later, the Mazama was rocked by a terrific blast that blew her bow out of the water. By some miracle, the ammunition in her hold did not detonate. The Mazama was severely damaged and started taking on water. Pumps were engaged to counteract flooding, and munitions were transferred to other ships. Tons of damaged munitions were dumped overboard. On this date in 1945, Geimer, along with his crewmates, were desperately trying to save their ship, caulking and plugging burst hull seams. The Mazama was eventually able to limp back to San Francisco for major repairs. By June, Bill and the Mazama were headed back to war with 5,000 tons of ammunition, remaining in the battle zone till the war ended. Bill Geimer left the Navy in 1946 and came back to North Dakota. He got an associate degree in mechanics and business in Wahpeton, married Carol Jett, and had two children. Bill Geimer passed away in 2014. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Scott Nelson. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, and after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Thursday on our show, we'll visit with Dr. J. Patrick Fawn. He's with CHI St. Alexius in Bismarck, and he'll talk about his personal experience as a hospital medical director during the pandemic. Tom Eason will share a Plains Folk essay, and Sue Balcom will drop by for Main Street Eats. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.